Okay, good afternoon, everyone. So the next item is Agenda Paper 1 on the Goodwill and Impairment Project. The board published a discussion paper with its preliminary views in mid-March. The objective of the project is to improve the information that companies provide to investors at a reasonable cost about the businesses those companies buy and to help hold management to account for their acquisition decisions. And the board is mainly trying to seek comments from stakeholders on how useful or feasible they think the new disclosure ideas are, as well as whether they have any new evidence or arguments on how goodwill should be accounted for. The purpose of this meeting is to provide an overview to members of the board's preliminary views. We would also like to take this opportunity to highlight some of the key questions that the board would like to receive from stakeholders through the discussion paper. There'll be an opportunity at the later ASAP meeting for members to provide feedback on the discussion paper. The other area of focus for the meeting today is to seek members' advice on how they think the board should go about its outreach and fieldwork activities, particularly in view of the current circumstances that we're all in at the moment. Slide 9 in the paper provides a summary of the board's preliminary view for each of the areas that the board has looked at in the discussion paper. This covers three main areas. The first relates to disclosures about the performance of acquisitions. The purpose of those disclosures is to provide users with the information they need to better understand the objectives that management had when they decided to acquire a company, and then whether those acquisitions were successful in achieving those objectives. The key principle is that companies would disclose the information management uses internally to monitor acquisitions. The board would like to hear stakeholders' views on the feasibility of these disclosures and also how companies monitor acquisitions. Where there are barriers to providing the information, the board would like to hear suggestions from stakeholders for overcoming these barriers. The second area the board looked at was the accounting for goodwill. Slides 18 and 19 outline the board's efforts to improve the effectiveness of the impairment test. The board could not find an alternative that was a significant improvement on the test in IAS 36, but the board would like to hear whether stakeholders have any suggestions of their own for improving the impairment test. The board also considered whether to reintroduce amortisation, and some of the arguments for reintroducing amortisation and for retaining the impairment-only approach are included on slide 21. Because there is no compelling evidence to suggest that reintroducing amortisation would significantly improve financial reporting, the board's preliminary view is to retain the existing impairment-only model. This was only by a narrow majority, and the board welcomed stakeholder views on this topic, in particular whether they considered the new arguments or evidence for either approach, or why some old arguments should be given more weight in the current environment. The board's preliminary views include some suggestions for simplifications of the test, by amending how value in use is estimated, and also moving to a trigger-based impairment test where the board is looking for feedback on the cost savings and the impact on the robustness of the test of these views. Finally, the board also considered some other topics, presenting equity excluding goodwill on the balance sheet, and whether to subsume some intangible assets acquired in a business combination into goodwill, the latter of which it decided not to do because there was no compelling evidence. The board's package of preliminary views tries to achieve an overall balance between providing more useful information to users and reducing costs for preparers. Slide 29 summarises the board's initial assessment of the costs and benefits of the preliminary views. The board also wants stakeholders to consider the board's preliminary views as a package rather than individual suggestions, and the board would like to hear stakeholders' views on what the package of proposals they think would best meet the objective of the project. The other topic that we would like to discuss with you is the outreach and fieldwork that we plan to do. We're planning to perform some fieldwork relating to the disclosure proposals, which we would like to seek help from preparers. The purpose of the fieldwork is to try to see how the board's preliminary view on the disclosures of the subsequent performance of acquisitions might be implemented, and to what extent they are feasible for preparers and provide useful information for investors. Of course, given the current circumstances we're all facing, these plans are subject to change. So, slide 5 has the questions for ASAP members. Do members need any clarification of the board's preliminary views? Do members have any advice on how the board should go about its outreach and fieldwork activities, especially in view of the current environment? And do members have any other comments that they would like to make? So, I hand the floor over to the members.
Tim, we couldn't really hear the last 3 minutes of what you were saying. Could you try to repeat the last comments you made?
Sorry. But where did you lose me?
Well, about 3 minutes ago.
I could hear. Okay.
Yeah. Could everybody hear? Okay. Then it was just me, perhaps. Okay. All right. Then we can go ahead. Who would like to take the floor?
Could I quickly, Hans?
Yes. Who's? Anthony. Yes.
Go ahead. Just quickly. I mean, clearly, outreach is going to be a major concern right now. I think we find in the UK amongst investors issues around goodwill for some is a topic in which they'll engage, but for many, it would in normal times be difficult to get them to engage. So I would suggest what you really need to do is a very directed outreach towards reaching out to investor groups rather than just waiting for them to come into you. So I think you're going to have to try even harder than normal to get investors to engage in this debate right now. You know, that concern right now is about, you know, liquidity, solvency, just where the cash is in a business. This will seem a very esoteric matter. So I think you've got to be very forceful in trying to get their attention. Just one other thing as well, I didn't read this in the paper, but I've heard it from some others, particularly at the recent CFSS meeting. And this is that for some, they believe that they're reading the discussion paper when it sets out the board's preliminary views, almost as if those views are already set, and they feel that for some, people will not engage in it because they will read the discussion paper and believe that the board's already made its mind up. I don't read that myself, but if others are, I think it's just one challenge you want to be aware of, is that if some might read it that way, you really got to be clear and say the message that, look, the views in there were to start the debate, not to end it. And really that to make sure everyone realizes that you are still open for comment, because as I say, so on the CFSS meeting felt that they were reading it as if you'd already made your mind up, and I know that's not true.
Okay, good points. Thank you, Anthony. Raymond.
Thank you, Hans. Just a comment on the slide 11, where the question is asked about whether or not investors get enough information about acquisitions and their subsequent performance. The concerns that we've heard there are that where you've got groups that have got a lot of acquisitions that occur within any given year, that we may find that the financial statements themselves become quite unwieldy in terms of, you know, just the amount of information that is provided. So I think we just need to bear that in mind as we embark on this process. I think it's important that the additional information is provided, but I think we just need to be careful that we don't end up adding more stuff back into the financial statements that we've been trying to declutter for the last little while. I mean, that's just a comment to bear in mind.
Sue?
And Raymond, are people saying that despite the fact that the discussion paper proposes that the information only be provided when it's sort of being monitored by the chief operating decision maker? So we've tried to ration it that way.
They are saying that. I think in spite of that, the reason for that being that you'll find that where you've got a lot of acquisitions happening within any one financial year, or I guess in this scenario, we're not really putting a time frame as to when does a company stop providing information. It may be over a 2 or 3 year period where there's a lot of acquisitions that are happening that may then end up, you know, while the decision makers are looking at the information, may end up in a situation where there's a lot of information that is in the financial statements, which may make it difficult to wade through.
Linda.
Thank you very much. I just wanted to echo and build on some of the comments that Anthony made, that the little feedback so far that we've been able to get was actually a bit ago, and we're also just seeing the same things where analysts are far less concerned about this topic right now. And so in terms of getting the support that you need and the feedback you need, the few people we were able to talk to suggested that when you're doing your outreach, make sure it's very targeted. Encourage the use of specific examples of the types of disclosures that you're wanting information back on. If you can give them examples, they're most likely to be able to respond to it in that fashion. We are encouraging people in the same vein to say, yes, it's early days and this is a discussion paper, but it's important that you get your views on the table now. And so, with that, we're prepared to help you get those views, but we think it's going to be very targeted given the circumstances. We know that you're already considering whether or not you're going to extend comment periods. We think you should take relative importance of your projects into consideration in this regard. But other than that, just mirroring the views that have already been expressed.
Chiara.
Yes, thank you. We haven't yet a position. We are still debating and preparing the discussion. But as Anthony was saying, we had our consultative forum standard setter last week, and the view that a more open approach, at least in communicating the intent to discuss more the possibility of the amortization was proposed at least by three countries in that forum, but was not shared by all the participants. Another similar suggestion would have been to be more open on the possibility to consider the different components when looking at the amortization, so to have different useful lives for different components of the goodwill. And it was observed that this could have been also a possibility to explore in the ED. In terms of the approach and the questions for preparers that you are proposing, the approach was shared, but of course there is a need to make it more flexible considering the current switching priorities, as it was already said before me by Linda and by Anthony. That's why in the letter that our board sent to you, this is one of the proposals where we would like to have more time to comment. And of course, we are trying to be as flexible as possible for targeted outreach and webinars, so to keep the attention and continue to collect the input through all the process.
Jim.
So just to be incremental, and I think good outreach plan and good suggestions, maybe a couple additional as it relates to the disclosures. When talking about disclosures that the CODM may use to evaluate acquisitions, questions come up in my mind as to whether those disclosures would be subject, at least in some environments, to internal controls and procedures that might be required, and if they're not already subject to that, what would be the incremental cost of having a system where those disclosures now go through financial statement level internal controls as opposed to the controls they may use simply for internal management reporting? And then also questions about whether or not those disclosures are audited, susceptible to audit, if so, at what cost? And when you think about disclosures, again, that management might be using, they might be designed for different purposes, and so might not easily fit immediately into an audit environment, or maybe they would. So I think focusing on what incremental impact would be required to put those statements or those disclosures out to the public.
Who else? I see Japan. Yes?
Yeah, thank you. We are beginning to understand the discussion paper, and we have two comments about the proposal. One general comment, which is related to the later session by the FASB, is that we generally believe that the ISB should keep its requirements converged with the requirements under US GAAP in the area of business combinations. Therefore, we expect that the ISB considers the development at the FASB when it discusses the improvements to its requirements. And the next comment is that about the fieldwork approach. Our understanding is that the ISB has developed the disclosure proposals based on the needs of users of financial statements, and the next focus will likely be the feasibility from the preparer's perspective. Accordingly, we agree that the fieldwork will be carried out with the preparer's participation. Nevertheless, we are unsure of whether the number of participating companies should be fixed around 15 to 20. It is true that it is not certain to it is possible to expand the participants, but we think the number could be flexible in order to ensure the diversity of companies in terms of geography and industry. That's all. Thank you.
All right. Oh, I must say, everybody very disciplined in focusing on outreach and the questions for outreach. You, China.
Okay, thank you, Chairman. First of all, I will say that in China, we actually, to be honest, I didn't read all the DP itself, not yet. It's a long paper. But currently, we decided to translate all the DP into Chinese. But in the past, we often translate the final standards of IFRS. This is the first time that we decide to translate the whole DP, although it's very long, because we. This project is very important for us in China, and we would like to better help the stakeholders to comment and encourage more stakeholders to comment on this project. That's the information I would like to share with you. And for the outreach, we have a suggestion that that maybe the regulators and auditors should also be included in the outreach and the fieldwork work, because there is a growing concern from the regulators and auditors over the large goodwill balances. Yeah, that's it. Thank you.
Nobu?
Yes, thank you. I'd like to share the views of the AOSSG. One AOSSG member welcomed the enhanced disclosures, but noted that the ISB needed to address the concerns regarding costs and commercial sensitivity. Regarding the presentation of equity excluding goodwill, one AOSSG member noted that this may raise the discussion of whether goodwill meets the definition of an asset. Several AOSSG members welcomed the outreach and fieldwork efforts by the ISB, but noted that the ISB should consider broader research to reflect the diversity of the views. One member noted that the ISB could use this opportunity to educate stakeholders and to seek views on the usefulness of the existing disclosures. One member noted that the ISB should consider the potential impact on the market and economy that may arise from the changes in the subsequent accounting for goodwill, considering that the goodwill balance has become large. Thank you.
Yeah, that balance could become a little bit less large in the next couple of months. But I see Korea.
Thank you. We are concerned that the proposed disclosures in the discussion paper would excessively increase the preparation cost. It is so our preliminary investigation suggests that the current set of disclosure requirements in IFRS 3 already appears to be quite heavy. So we think it is necessary to review carefully whether additional disclosures proposed by the discussion paper will be necessary and practicable at reasonable cost. So in this sense, we recommend that greater weight should be given to preparers when the ISP perform outreach. Thank you.
Thank you, Jeho. Tommaso. Tommaso, I think you're muted. I cannot hear you. Could anybody else hear Tommaso?
I could not hear him.
Patrick?
Oh. Yeah. Well, whenever you're ready, I have some comments.
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay. Point one, it's not easy, as a number of people mentioned, to mobilize on the topic
at the moment. But at the moment is only partly true. The mobilization is not obvious even without the current circumstances for two reasons. Reason one is that many analysts do restatements anyway, and they will consider the P&L excluding the impact of impairments if they feel that it's not appropriate or under the right timing. And the second reason is that most analysts develop their own assessments, and to a certain extent, they have formed their views before the accountants do. So that's the first point. The second point is that to a large extent, there is a debate on the fact that there is an issue. Some people believe there is an issue. Other people do not believe there is a real issue. And as a consequence, objective data are much needed. I think we should, in the context of the discussion paper and the outreach, try to objectivize a little bit the evolution of goodwill over time, the fact that it's too little, too late or not, or in marginal cases, and see if the model is broken. Remark number three is that, of course, the discussion paper is brand new and we need to consider. However, there is the elephant in the room, which is the question on which a preliminary position has been taken, which is let's explore how to improve disclosures and impairment. But the question of amortization remains the elephant in the room for a number of participants. And that is somehow destabilizing the current process, because some people will probably reintroduce the question of amortization versus impairment only via the paper. And people think that the ISB is divided and that the balance of opinion could change. So I think think it is, this is the most critical question for me, because it is a, if we were to move to an amortization system, I consider that it would be a major accounting change as compared to a stabilized platform. And therefore, you know, further analysis and impact analysis and impact should be made before leaving that possibility open. Thank you.
Okay. Who is next? Tommaso. Yeah, try again. I still cannot hear you.
No, I can't hear it.
No, it doesn't react.
Hans, may I? This is Patrick.
Yeah.
I see you on video, but I use the audio to speak. It depends on the system you have.
Yeah, yeah. Well, Tommaso, perhaps you can see if you can do something about the situation. Patrick suggests you use your audio. Perhaps you can just, yeah, okay. All right. Anybody else? Changwu.
Yes. There are so many helpful comments for our team to develop this discussion paper more and more. Just one question on that cost. The gym, in the case of US, could you share some experiences with us on the kind of a potential increase in cost when we propose this kind of a disclosure requirement comparing to some kind of the requirements of a segment reporting? The approach we are suggesting is quite similar to the approach that was used in the segment reporting. So we expect still the benefits, expected benefits might be bigger, larger than the increased cost of their this kind of proposals. How do you think about the both sides of benefits and costs of our proposals comparing to your experience in the segment reporting?
I think good question, Changwu. My point wasn't that the cost would outweigh the benefit. It was just looking at the slides. There were no questions in the outreach about it. It said you would utilize a segment approach. It's not clear to me that the disclosures that management utilizes would be identical to the types of disclosures they use for segments or not. And I think the discussion paper is appropriately broad-based to say whatever disclosures the CODM is using. I don't know if those would be the same types of disclosures that you would have for segment performance or not. Presumably, they might be different. If they are different, even though the CODM may be using them, are they the types of, is it the type of information that comes out of a system that's subject to control and discipline that you would expect in an IFRS set of financial statements? And if not, what would be necessary to do that? And then what costs would you have for audit? And it may still well be that those costs would be insignificant compared to the benefits. It was just making sure you gather that as part of your outreach. So I didn't have any predisposed view.
All right, thanks.
Do you hear me now?
Tommaso?
Yes, do you hear me?
Loud and clear.
Oh, finally.
Go ahead.
Perfect. I used the old way to fix the problems, to disconnect and reconnect.
Always good.
No, I have a very quick comment. I really appreciate the plan for field work and outreach. I really believe that this item will be very, very discussed, debated in our country. I think that among the questions raised, one which is very important for preparers is to understand whether this level of disclosure create any problem about commercial, they become commercially sensitive. So the real issue I see at this stage is the timing. We have difficulties at this stage to concentrate in reading and understanding the DP and involving our stakeholders, which you can imagine are concentrated on all the disruptions that are related with the coronavirus. So I think we have planned to have a conference with the ISB participating earlier in May, and we have to postpone, probably don't know when, in if. So I think the timing is the real issue. But we are happy to work with the ISB in promoting the outreach, as we did, we continue to do, for example, for primary financial statements. Regarding the DP itself, we really have to debate with our stakeholders. My impression is that a long of debate that will be around question number 7 on amortization, on which I think the message that I understand is that the ISB is open-minded to receive input to decide on how to move on. Thank you.
Okay. Yes, you.
Thank you, Chairman. May I just add something, preliminary feedback from some stakeholders in China. Just as I said that we will issue an invitation to comment in China when we finish the translation. But currently, based on the agenda paper, we did have some consultation with a limited number of stakeholders. I just want to summarize the some preliminary comments from them. First one on the proposal to example the impairment of goodwill every year. People suggest that the board could provide more guidance on indication of impairment. Otherwise, the too little problem will still exist. Second, on the improved disclosure, people generally agreed to improve the information disclosure, but they also are concerned about the cost, and they are concerned about maybe some information may contain sensitive information and may not be easily verifiable by the auditors. That's the second point. Third, some stakeholder raised concern on the presentation of total equity excluding goodwill, because this number can be achieved by a simple calculation using the disclosed data. So what's the economic substance of this item? They have a little concern about the usefulness of the information. That's the third one. The last one is about the amortization. Actually, based on the limited number of feedback, people have mixed views. Some people suggest amortization plus impairment, and they even suggest, and they even provide suggestions on the how to decide the amortization period. I think we will have more detailed discussion later in the next subsession, right? So I will not go that in detail. While at the same time, some people have different views. They are in support of the impairment only approach because although this is maybe it's a problem worldwide. Many companies in different jurisdictions have large balances of goodwill. But if the people are concerned that if the amortization is used, that would have a very great impact on the financial position and operating result of the company. So they suggest the board to have more research and outreach on the amortization approach, and also pay attention to the possible impact of amortization on the company's financial position, on the capital market, and even on the economic development. The final goal is to find out a reasonable solution to the goodwill measurement. Yeah, that's it. Thank you.
Okay. I don't think I see any further people who want to contribute. So, Tim, did you want to raise any other questions, or are we done, basically?
I think we can move fast, please.
Okay. All right, then, Michelle, can we move on to the next topic? I can't hear you.
So we're staying on this topic. But I think the FASB are going to present a paper now, an overview of their paper.
Oh, yes, of course, yes. Please, Jim, are you going to present, or one of your staff members?
Yes, I'll present.
Okay, please.
It's just an overview of our invitation to comment. We issued an invitation to comment in July of last year. That invitation to comment was, I would say, more narrowly focused than the invitation to comment that you have issued, principally on goodwill, the subsequent accounting for goodwill, and then more limited questions on disclosure. Our disclosure questions were focused on disclosures about goodwill as opposed to the acquisitions themselves, which is why I say a little more narrowly requesting input. And then we also talked, had a couple of questions about intangibles themselves and whether certain intangibles should be subsumed into goodwill, and then disclosures about acquired intangibles. We also sought feedback on recent changes that we've made to goodwill impairment testing. One about 7-8 years ago to introduce what we call step zero, which is a it's still an annual requirement to test goodwill, but we introduced a qualitative test that if you pass the qualitative criteria or you can evaluate goodwill qualitatively, you don't have to do a quantitative test. And then the second change we made to goodwill was to align it more closely with IFRS and not require a purchase price allocation if you fail the goodwill impairment test. What we had required before was what we call step two, to go through and value every individual asset and liability to get back to the residual to more closely, at the time we thought, capture what the economic decline in goodwill was. We found that the precision around those tests and how investors use that information indicated that that was just a costly or unnecessary test. And of course, it aligns more closely with IFRS. So that's the information we sought feedback on. We got just over 100 comment letters, and we also conducted a roundtable with two sessions with 12 to 15 participants at each session. Thank you very much to Mary Tokar, who participated from the IASB, and Nobu. Of course, if I don't capture this correctly, Nobu, you can feel free to add any commentary that you took away from the roundtable as well.
The good news coming out of this is no matter what your view is on the subsequent accounting for goodwill, you can find comment letters that support your point of view. The bad news is we did not, I would say we really did not drive to a point where we had significant new information and or a consensus view. That doesn't mean we can't move forward and evaluate what the next steps are, but I would say the first question we asked was, what is the nature of goodwill? So if you already had your views on the nature of goodwill, those comment letters probably support your view. Valuation professionals, by and large, said they think goodwill is a non-wasting asset, doesn't have a definite life, and therefore should not be amortized. Other comment letters came in and said that, of course, goodwill that is acquired does have a wasting nature, and it is only replenished by the company over time by additional investment. So the acquired goodwill goes away and is subsumed by internal goodwill. So just the nature of really the comments supporting views that people probably came in entrenched in already. A number of commenters said the boards had it right in IFRS and in US GAAP in the basis for conclusion on the various components of goodwill, that of course goodwill doesn't represent a single thing. And quite frankly, that I think is the most compelling to me, that goodwill can mean different things in different acquisitions. But again, doesn't mean we shouldn't think further about the accounting. I would say I'll start with maybe beyond the nature of goodwill, the recent changes that we made to goodwill, feedback was generally supportive. Certainly people like the idea of convergence with IFRS on eliminating step two, even though some said that might be a less precise measure of the actual impairment. On step one or step zero, the introduction of a qualitative test, the time period in which we sought feedback probably made performing a qualitative test easier. So the feedback was, hey, useful, but we're not sure in times of stress whether it will be particularly useful or not. So minimal cost reduction, but some cost reduction nonetheless. I would say that was the majority of the comment, although some commenters said in a rigorous environment of oversight, they were doing as much work to prove the qualitative test as they were to do quantitative. So of course it was just easier for them to go about calculating fair value of the reporting unit in any case. Going on to that, we have a slide that really gets to the heart of the subsequent impairment. It's the slide that says diversity of respondents' views on page four. And this really gets to the subsequent accounting for goodwill. We had folks in really every quadrant on this slide. That is, some saying impairment only is, of course, the right way to account for goodwill from a conceptual standpoint. Those are the folks that had the view that goodwill is a non-wasting asset. They also indicated, at least some users, that impairment only, well, it may be either too little or too late, it's at least directionally informative. And those users felt that amortization would not be informative to them at all. Others support impairment only from a practical standpoint. Their assessment and their responses was the system is generally working, and that while cost might be high, it's not too high. So why tinker with or why change something that was working? Of course, on the other side of the argument, and of course, also none of these are new, is that impairment with amortization is conceptually sound because goodwill, in their view, is a wasting asset. It's finite life. Goodwill represents the excess cash flows that you expect from an acquisition. Those cash flows that you've acquired have a finite life unless they're replenished by additional investment by new management. So therefore, amortization would be more reflective of, in their view, the economics. And I would say we had a number of folks in sort of the bottom right quadrant that said, from a practical standpoint, ignore the conceptual arguments. that amortization with impairment still has the benefit of identifying business acquisition, I'll call it failures for lack of a better word, because impairment would, of course, identify those situations in the early years. That impairment only, if it doesn't identify those in early years, tends not to be a signal of the success of an acquisition or not, because the factors after integration or a number of years probably relate less to that acquired business and more to the business as a whole. We'll see impairments in the current environment that probably aren't indicative of acquisition success or failure in any way, shape, or form, but reflective of a global crisis. And so is that really providing investors with decision useful information? And from a practical standpoint, amortization would then reduce the cost. And a number of those cited at least very preliminary data in the US that says goodwill is a critical audit matter. We've introduced similar reporting to that, which is around the world in reporting key audit matters or critical audit matters. And in about 30% of critical audit matters reporting in the U.S., goodwill is included in that. And of course, about 30% of public companies have material balances of goodwill. So there seems to be a high correlation of goodwill being a critical audit area, higher than revenue recognition in terms of critical audit area. And some view that as indicative of perhaps a level of cost that's unnecessary given investors' views of the benefit or lack thereof of impairment testing. Maybe just turn to the last slide on user views. And this is another area where the user views would tend to support whatever your view is. We had users that said they do favor impairment only, that while it doesn't provide significant information, it's at least confirmatory, so don't change. We had other users that said that the value of that information ought to be considered in the context of the cost providing it. And so if the cost is too high, they could certainly understand moving to a different model. And the last box there, we had investors that said they're indifferent to the accounting outcome. They already take account of their view of the fair value of the enterprise, which is, of course, their job. And so whether we require impairment or whether we require amortization, it's not particularly useful. It's backed out in their models. Just quickly, and I don't have a slide for this, on disclosures. Our disclosures were focused on disclosures about goodwill and passing or failing the test, and whether we ought to have more forward-looking disclosures about performing goodwill impairment analyses where the test was passed, but only marginally. The feedback on that was generally negative, saying that's more appropriate in MD&A. And of course, in the US, it's already required by the SEC where material. And so please don't take anything away from our ITC as it relates to the types of disclosures that you're proposing under your invitation or discussion document. I think they're just a different set. So that's an update on what we heard. Our next steps, we had initially planned to have the staff bring this input back to us. I think your slides say in a March 25th or 26th meeting. That clearly didn't happen. We're also taking stock of the pace of accounting standard setting to focus on priority and urgent issues. And so I think our next steps are somewhere TBD. And forgive me, I did forget one important aspect of what we asked, and it was the importance of consistency. And there we focused on, one, should we allow public companies an option to amortize versus impair? And the feedback, I think, was very clear that optional accounting would not be productive. We asked about consistency between public companies and private companies in the U.S. Private companies have an ability to amortize. Public companies do not. So the feedback was relatively split, probably a majority saying not important to be aligned, but certainly a strong minority thought we ought to consider alignment. But we probably on consistency had the clearest message that it is desirable to be globally consistent. That is, this is a converged standard, and so a strong desire by our constituents to continue to strive for global consistency. I would say a strong desire. It wasn't unanimous, but I think at least to me, a clear enough message that it's important that we continue to work together.
Okay, that is very good to hear, Jim, and to hear that people want us to stay on one page in this respect, and I personally think that would be extremely important as well. Any questions to Jim for this very interesting overview? Yes, Tommaso.
Do you hear me?
Yeah.
Yeah, I always ask, sorry. Thank you very much, Jim. It's very interesting, your slides. I would have many comments, but maybe one, I will concentrate on slide number four, on the conceptual reasons for impairment only and impairment with amortizations. I don't know if you heard two issues that I find very, very important in this debate. One is the comparability among entities that created their business throughout the business combinations and companies that did not. And this is the issue about the fact that with impairment only, some argue that you're recognizing implicitly internally generating goodwill, while other companies cannot. And another point that maybe was raised before, generally by Chiara, which is very, very important for me, is that the accounting goodwill in US GAAP is clearly the same, but I think it is that there's part of this goodwill on studies that I read, like 30% of the value of the amount of goodwill is determined by the accounting mismatch with the recognition of deferred taxes on the revaluation of other assets and liabilities and business combination. So one part of the goodwill is just a counterpart of the deferred taxes of other items. I from a conceptual point of view, I don't know if for this part of goodwill is still valid. Debating about whether this is the wasting or not wasting asset. I don't know if you heard these arguments.
Yes, on your first point about internal growth versus growth or organic growth versus growth through acquisition, we did get commenters that suggested the lack of amortization might encourage growth through acquisition. And discourage growth through organic means, because of course, if you grow organically, you're recognizing any internally developed goodwill through that, through the P&L. You're not increasing your balance sheet for goodwill that grows organically, and that to then not do that for growth through acquisition might have a bias one way or the other. It'd be interesting, and I think we'll try and see, does academic literature support one of those views or not. And I think that Patrick said it well, that much of the input that we've gotten to date really is anecdotal versus researched evidence. And I think that's one thing I take away from this, but we certainly heard that argument. We also did have people talk about the components of goodwill, how much is because of accounting mismatch, whether that's because of deferreds or other things that are not measured, I would say precisely in a business combination. So deferred taxes, maybe some aspects of revenue recognition, contingencies, and other items. What we, I think, heard from for the most part was, while goodwill has different aspects, that trying to further define goodwill into those aspects and then assign different accounting to those aspects is probably not, at this point, at least in our constituents' view, a useful exercise. We contemplated that when we did work on the converged standards. I think the feedback we heard at the time was, of course, goodwill has different components, but actually assigning value to those different components and then trying to assign differing useful lives to those components was not viewed as cost beneficial then. And folks did not, at least at this point, see any reason that it would be necessarily now. Although we did hear feedback from some that they don't view customer relationships as distinguishable from goodwill. That is, the sort of a customer relationship intangible really is hoped for future revenue. We heard many view that as really just a component of goodwill. And of course, we do separate that component and amortize it, and we don't separate other aspects of goodwill. So some suggested that we already do it to a slight degree.
Thank you.
Any other comments to Jim? Questions? Yes, Anthony. Anthony.
Thank you. Yeah. thank you. Yeah. So on the same slide, on slide four. I mean, what really jumped out at me was the text at the top saying overall response fees are specific topic were often contingent on other changes. And about the interaction with other standards in other areas. I think that's a lesson for the ISB to reflect on when it's going through the through this discussion, is to be careful that issues aren't separated so far and discussed at such a granular level that the interaction isn't considered. The obvious point would be how introducing amortization might relieve some of those pressures on the separate recognition of intangibles Jim was just talking about. So for example, there wouldn't be as much of a need to separately identify, let's say, customer relationships if goodwill generally was being amortized. And I just picked that up as one example, that we must be careful not to break this down into such discrete separate issues. We fail to think about the real interconnectedness of goodwill, intangibles, impairment, that there are interactions across the whole lot. So yeah, the text at the top of four, I think, is important. Slide four. The other point I just want to make, that the point about international harmonization or continuing harmonization between B and the ISB, I do think that's important, but clearly it is not an issue that trumps all others. We've still got to try and seek what we think within our separate constituencies are the appropriate accounting. But harmonization is one of those influences in decision-making rather than a defining kind of objective or criteria.
Hans, one question, if I may.
Yes, Patrick.
One question to Jim. In your ITC, did you hear a suggestion to change for private companies?
We did not. So private companies in the U.S. today have the ability to amortize on an optional basis. We've heard that that's working relatively well. That is, smaller private companies without aspirations to go public can amortize goodwill. Their users maybe have different perspectives than a equity holder in a capital market. Larger private companies in the U.S. that have a broader desire either to go public or to be acquired by a public company might be hesitant to adopt goodwill amortization. That's where there was a slight tension, saying it would be nice for those companies to have more alignment public to private. But I would say that wasn't a driving factor for change. That was more of a small irritant.
One more comment, if I may. I am asking myself if in the consultation we are covering enough the tax deductibility systems and their impact on the accounting preferences? Because so from one jurisdiction to the other, there might be different statuses that might influence the treatment and the perception.
Yes, and I didn't get in. We did ask questions about if we were to amortize, what period should we require amortization over? In the U.S., goodwill is generally tax deductible, and it's a bright line, 15 years. So some did suggest if we were going to move to amortization, there would be a desirability to just pick a date of 15 years so that you didn't have to create deferreds. If you're going to simplify, then simplify. And if you pick 15 years, you wouldn't create a deferred tax difference. But I don't think that was driven by a majority either. That was probably a smaller factor by most commenters.
That takes me to the idea that during the outreach, we should ask this question.
Okay. Is there anybody else? If not, then I suggest we move on to Tiernan. Tiernan, you're going to give a presentation.
Yes, thanks, Hans. I think actually we'll be starting with Atsushi at the ASBJ. I'll hand it over to him first.
Yeah, thank you very much. We are honored to have this opportunity to explain our research paper. And I, Atsushi Itabashi from ASBJ, and Tiernan from HKICPA will make presentation together. First half, I will make the presentation. This paper is a joint work between the HKICPA staff and the ASBJ staff. So please take a look at Agenda Paper 1B. The second page provides the objective of the research paper. Through this paper, we would like to provide relevant and timely analysis to the Goodwill Project, thereby contributing to the global discussion in this area. The paper consists of four parts, and the main parts discuss updated results of the quantitative study and the improvements to subsequent accounting for goodwill. I will explain the quantitative study first, then regarding the subsequent accounting, I will discuss the SBJSF view, and Tiernan from the HKICPA will explain the HKICPSF view. Firstly, the quantitative study. Please turn to page 4. This study was originally conducted in 2016. Its aim is to provide quantitative information as a basis for discussion, mainly using the data provided in financial statements. The updated study followed the structure of the previous study that was conducted using the data from 2005 to 2014. The differences are that we have included companies that constitute Hong Kong Hang Seng Composite Index, and that we have only included Japanese companies that applied IFRS in 2018. Now, the updated study used the data from 2014 to 2018. The outcome of the study was similar to that in the previous study, some of which are more explicit in the updated one. We can observe a similar increasing trend of goodwill, and it would take long to fully expense goodwill. In addition, as you can see in the next slide, there are many companies that have a large amount of goodwill in comparison with the amount of their net assets. Based on this study, we observe that it is likely that the too little too late issue exists. Please turn to page 7. Based on the quantitative study, the paper discusses how to address the too little too late issue. Both the HKICPA staff and the ASBJ staff think that acquired goodwill should be basically a distinct unit of account, and acquired goodwill should be subject to amortization plus indicator-based impairment. The paper explains this common view from our respective perspectives. Please turn to page 8. The SBJ staff think that one of the contributions of this paper is that we list the issues regarding the subsequent accounting for goodwill. This helps to clarify how stakeholders differ in their views rather than plainly explaining their rationales. In our view, the most important difference is the lack of consensus regarding the nature of goodwill. The paper discusses its wasting nature based on the traditional analysis of the components of goodwill. We think that financial statements should reflect this nature by applying amortization. In relation, the paper discusses the amortization period. The SBJ staff argue that it should be based on management estimate, but a maximum number of years should be established to strike a balance between the provision of relevant information and the need to address the too little too late issue. Now I hand over to Tianan. Tianan, please.
Thanks, Atsushi. So if you'll all look at page 9, I'll present the HKI CPA staff view. So basically what we tried to do is we first tried to set out a concept which we termed economic goodwill. And we did this because we wanted to show what we consider is the difference between acquired goodwill, which is the goodwill we all know recognized under IFRS 3, internally generated goodwill, and then what we call economic goodwill, which we define as the fair value of an entity less the book value or the identifiable net assets. And that could be under any prevailing accounting standard. And the reason why we create this definition is we want to try and emphasize that goodwill can effectively be seen as an amount, or one might say actually more as a part of an asset, that asset being an entity as a whole rather than really as a standalone asset in itself. And additionally, we try to emphasize that acquired goodwill as recognized under IFRS 3 is really something that can be described as a snapshot. It's static, it cannot be remeasured, and that leads us into some of the rationale we'll talk about next. So if you then look at slide 10, we go over some of our key points as to why we think that reintroducing amortization plus impairment will help improve financial reporting. One of the first reasons is that we think it will better reflect the nature of goodwill, and we have three points under this. The first is that, as mentioned before, acquired goodwill is a static concept, and we think that over time, it really loses relevance on the balance sheet. If you take an extreme example, think about, for instance, a company that recognizes goodwill and then 50 years later still has it on its balance sheet when the underlying entity has perhaps changed its business entirely. At such a point, that goodwill balance is really nonsensical, as would be any corresponding impairment charge at that point. The second reason is that we think that amortization provides a better opportunity to show how an acquisition is utilized. So we don't look at whether it's wasting or non-wasting as much. We think that, first of all, if you purchase an entity and then you capitalize the goodwill, once you start monetizing that acquisition, you're going to be double counting because you're going to be inflating your assets and retained earnings at the same time as you have the goodwill remaining on the balance sheet. So we think there should be a corresponding amortization charge. Finally, on that point, we think, as mentioned, I think by the FASB before, we believe that amortization will improve comparability between entities that grow organically versus those that grow through acquisitions. And our second main point is that we think that the current impairment-only model is perhaps supporting large goodwill balances in a way that may negatively incentivize management and perhaps misrepresent risks. We provide more detail in our research paper, but basically we think, firstly, the existing requirement is perhaps pro-cyclical, and also it leads to balance sheets being inflated with a highly nebulous asset that cannot be liquidated. We also think it may negatively incentivize management in terms of offering opportunity for big bath accounting practices, levering against, again, speculative assets, and also affecting the ability for management to make certain corporate actions, such as dividends distributions, which I think is something we saw was an issue in the Carillion case recently in the UK. Similar to the ASBJ, we propose amortization. In terms of how we want to determine the amortization period, we suggest looking at the expected utilization of the acquisition. We don't think that you should look at the useful life because we don't think that goodwill has an economic useful life, but we do think that management should have a plan and an objective for their acquisition. So similar as to what is proposed in the discussion paper regarding disclosures, I think that internal management information can be used to help inform the expected amortization period. So with that, that concludes our staff view, and I would like to move to page 12 as to the questions for ASAF members. So we would like to ask, what do you think about the significant amounts of goodwill on balance sheets? Is too little too late a problem? Does this perhaps affect management incentives or misrepresent risks? Secondly, does amortization better reflect the nature of goodwill or improve financial reporting? If so, would you agree with one of our arguments presented in our research paper? And thirdly, if goodwill were to be amortized, how would you think the amortization period and pattern be determined?
Okay. Any comments or questions for Jernan? Yes, Tommaso?
Thank you. Thank you, the colleagues, for the very interesting presentation. I really find useful the updates you do of your quantitative information about the ratio between goodwill and net assets. On this, I probably missed something, but my question is whether I know that in Japan probably goodwill is amortized. It is why we have this low rate. My question is whether in Hong Kong is the same. But I have also another question to the members of Hong Kong. I heard you were mentioning the procyclical effects of having the large number amount of goodwill and sudden probably impair this goodwill could raise equity to zero or to negative value. I suspect that this is the one of the topic that is really important to consider in this consultation, because probably this is something that we have learned in the last years, hopefully only. But my question is whether you believe that these procyclical effects are really based on accounting figures or a mix of accounting figures and local law about dividend distribution or minimum capital requirements.
Sure. So I can answer I can answer the latter question, then I'll leave the question on the quantitative study to Atsushi. On the latter question, I would recommend you refer to our contribution by Professor Adam Lever on the pro-cyclicality effect. So I think that accounting obviously is not the only reason behind that. Certainly there are many other factors to consider, but nevertheless, I think that the goodwill accounting regime as it stands does have some impact. And I think that that can also be seen if you look in the discussion paper from the ISB. They reference, I think it was a FASB or another American study that found that the non-expensing of goodwill actually does engender higher acquisition prices. And so I think that just logically that's something that would happen. And so when you get higher acquisition prices, you combine that with a low interest rate, easy credit environment, that's naturally going to push a pro-cyclical effect as you get rising goodwill balances. And then in turn, when you have frothy balance sheets as a result of that, that would then perhaps create even further incentives to perform additional high dollar value acquisitions, as again noted in our research paper in that section. With that, I'll pass it to Atsushi for the quantitative study question.
Yeah, thank you, TNN. Regarding the question about the Japanese companies, yeah, Japanese GAAP requires entities to amortize goodwill, but in this context, I would like to exclude those effects as much as possible. So the scope of the company is now the Japanese company that applies IFRS. Considering that the Japanese companies transitioned from Japanese GAAP to IFRS in the meantime, so the effect of amortization cannot be completely excluded from the data, but the data itself is based on the companies that apply IFRS. If you can see the research paper 1A, agenda paper 1A, and page 9, you can see that scope in footnote 2. Japanese companies, for this explains the scope of the Japanese company. Yeah, that following companies that apply IFRS were included in the population, considering that there were companies that have transitioned from IFRS were included, either Japanese GAAP or US GAAP to IFRS between 2014 to 2018. So the number of companies that are in the scope is now very few. So as you can see in the Appendix A, the number is of Japanese companies that are in the data is only 59 at the balance sheet data and 27 at the income statement data. Thank you.
Thank you.
Anthony?
Thank you, Hans. I just wanted to come back to the Hong Kong research and analysis. I think what you're trying to do there in your analysis, I think is very, very worthwhile approach, which is to move away from the kind of conceptual debates about whether it's a wasting asset, not a wasting asset. I mean, actually, you seem to indicate to an extent you don't even believe it is an asset. It's something coming from the, it's some part of the overall asset of the business, I think you call it. But I think that is the way forward, is actually to think about what is the usefulness of this information. Some of the constituents in the US responded to FASB's research, talked about information utility. And I think I read that into your analysis about why amortization plus impairment. It isn't about going back to some sort of fundamental concepts of accounting. It's actually a far starker analysis of more direct analysis. Is this information at all useful? Now where do we hear of the usefulness of this information? Does seem to be in partly about if an impairment is recognised, it does provide confirmatory value. It does indicate that there's been a poor acquisition. Well, that only seems to happen in the early years, and indeed that's even one of what's said in the responses to the US, that impairment-only model has an information utility in the early years. But I think what you are highlighting is over time, it becomes increasingly less representative of the entity. This number that is now sitting on the balance sheet has less and less information value. It is telling you less and less about the underlying economics because of shielding, because of restructuring, because of everything. And I really do think that that's where one will find a case for amortization on plus impairment, or indeed a case for impairment. Only it will be by thinking not about concepts of accounting, but just thinking about the number that happens to sit in the balance sheet or will happen to be recognized in the income statement. What is the information utility, the information value of that? And I commend the AKI CPA in trying to explore this in that way. I don't agree with that, every piece of the analysis. I think with 1B, you're actually falling back into the trap a little bit of saying it is an asset and we are expensing an asset. Whereas I think, you know, be a bit more bold, a bit more consistent in where your argument starts, which is, okay, what is the information value to this? Does it tell you anything about the underlying economics? Does it tell you anything about the business, given the way the numbers have risen?
Was that you?
I think Sue was saying I was cutting out, but she was cutting out when she was saying it.
Okay.
Hans, I have a
question. Right, any more? Yes,
Hans,
Sue?
I have a question that Nick Anderson didn't
really hear what you said.
Yes, Michelle?
Sorry, I have a question that Nick Anderson has asked me to pose to the ASBJ and the Hong Kong ICPA. So he says both approaches suggest a maximum amortization period of 10 years. And this would mean that a goodwill amortization charge for a transaction that creates a significant value would be exactly the same as the transaction that creates a modest value. He struggles to see how this would provide useful information for investors. In these circumstances, do the benefits of simplification outweigh other considerations?
That's a good question.
It's not mine.
Still a good question. Does Atsushi or Chernan want to address it?
I would like to respond to the question about setting the cap on the amortization period. So Nick may question about the usefulness of setting the cap or maximum amortization period. I think it is not relevant to set an amortization period, maximum amortization period, because I already discussed this issue in the page 50 of the agenda paper 1A. Paragraph 4.14 says that it is not logically set to agenda paper 1A 4.13 paragraph 4.13. We acknowledge that this is inconsistent with the objective of approach one. The approach one says that the required management to estimate the amortization period, taking into the nature of acquired goodwill. And approach one considers the diversity of business combination, and this relies on the management estimate because amortization period should reflect the diversity of the business diversity in the nature of business combination. So, as mentioned in paragraph 4.13, this is inconsistent with the objective of this approach. But we think that the too little, too late issue is growing, and many are concerned with this issue. So. Setting maximum amortization period would be effective to reduce that concern. So this is counter to the relevant providing relevant information, but I'd like to suggest this because to strike balance between the necessity of addressing this issue and the provision of relevant information.
And maybe I can also respond from the HKI CPA perspective. We think that by basing the amortization period on the expected utilization, that will actually provide relevant and useful information and tend to actually align with the disclosure ideas currently being considered under the discussion paper. Our proposal for a 10-year rebuttable presumption is in order to address the concerns that are raised by some of our stakeholders and also our partners, such as the ASBJ, regarding some entities who may take undue advantage of that and extend the amortization period out to, 100 years or what have you. So the 10-year rebuttable presumption in our perspective just helps provide some built-in sort of a backstop there.
Jungwoo?
Thank you. I have a question, Tianan. Nice to see you back. Could you explain the concept of utilization and a consumption while wasting? You said in the beginning when you made the presentation, you vaguely touched the relationship between these two utilization concept and the wasting concept. However, you use the utilization concept for the base of amortization on your slide 9. So this is a very key concept, whether which direction we should go. So could you explain a little more about the relationship between these concepts, Tiana?
Sure. Nice to see you again, too, Chengwu. So the way we describe utilization is if you think, okay, I make an acquisition and I, say, plan to earn $1,000 a year on it every year for the next 5 years, and then it's going to be fully integrated. Say that's my forecast period. We would think of utilization is the monetization of that asset. So in that very, of that acquisition. So in that very simple example, I would set my amortization period as 5 years. If I monetize that acquisition in line with my expectations, so $1,000 a year, I then amortize that on a straight line basis every single year. And then I hopefully have at least some comparability in my amortization going through my P&L statement and also the benefits that I'm monetizing, right? The income, which is then inflating my assets and my retained earnings. And in that way, that helps avoid the double counting problem I mentioned earlier, and also helps to show the utilization of that acquisition, because you're now linking its monetization with its accounting. And when we talk about in respect of the amortization period, wanting it to be the period in which the acquisition is utilized, we're talking again about the same concept. So my plan is that my acquisition will be basically monetized over a 5-year forecast period. After that point, it's either going to be fully integrated and indistinguishable, or maybe I'll spin it off, who knows. But that 5 years is that is my expected utilization. And I think from a conceptual point of view, we think that goodwill itself, again, is an amount. It doesn't have an economic life. It doesn't behave like any other economic asset which we're familiar with, and for that reason we propose that we should account for it in the way that we actually will be using the acquisition.
Thank you. Can I have one more question to the ASBJ? Are you going to explore more what goodwill is in nature, whether goodwill is a kind of a wasting asset or not?
Yeah. One of the analysis is already done in our research paper, but if there are various comments we can see from the respondents' responses, based on the discussion paper, your discussion paper, I would like to explore further about the nature of the goodwill.
Yes, the final question is, both of you prefer the kind of amortization approach. These kind of position of your two organizations are based on general position of your whole stakeholders in your each country?
From the SBJ, yeah. Amortization, supporting amortization is the basically the general position of the Japan.
From the HKI CPA, we've heard mixed views from the outreach we have done with users. Amortization has been the rough position agreed upon by the Financial Reporting Standards Committee of the HKI CPA in terms of their acknowledgement of our research paper. We are now proceeding with further outreach for the ISB's discussion paper and our own ITC on that. So we'll have more information in the future on that.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Yes, Tim? Tim?
Sorry. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah, Tim, go ahead.
Yeah, can you hear me okay?
Well, not okay, but I can hear you, yeah.
Okay, that's fine. I just wanted just to come back on something that was said earlier in our session by Anthony and Kira, and it's relevant to this because I just thank the ASBJ and the HKI CPA for their papers. I mean, it'll be useful. It's useful feedback for the board as it looks for feedback on the discussion on amortization. And it's just really just to say, in terms of what Anthony was saying about, you know, his interpretation of what was in the discussion paper, the board has put a preliminary view in the discussion paper about whether to reintroduce amortization or not, and the decision was the preliminary view was not to, but the board is open to hear feedback from stakeholders on that particular topic. It's looking for evidence to understand whether there is clear evidence for the need for a change and to reintroduce amortization. So I just wanted to make that quick point. Thank you.
Okay, did anybody else want to come in? No, that's not the case. Any more for this session? Or are we at the end? Okay, I think we can close off this discussion then. Thank you for all your contributions, some very helpful advice for our outreach program. We'll have to see in the light of current circumstances whether we will have to adjust the program. Probably we will. But thank you thus far, and we will resume this discussion probably in the not so distant future. Okay, are we ready to go on with primary financial statements?
I think we already have Aida, Nick, and Rachel online, and then.
Okay.
I think we just need to. I think in terms of ASAF members, it's Raymond. One, he is representing both the AOSSG and the KSB for this session.
Yeah. Okay. All right. So, Aida, can I give you the floor?